Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is they're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Today, I'm talking with Jessica Wheatcraft, owner and director of behavior and training at Instinct Dog Training San Diego. Jessica's talk, Advanced Concepts and Leash Reactivity, What, When, and How to Change Criteria at the Aggression and Dogs Conference 2022, introduced trainers to a new way of thinking about cues and reward markers while working with dogs showing leash reactive behavior, barrier aggression, and other forms of aggressive behaviors. Today, Jessica and I talked about why she became a trainer and what being a trainer is really like. Why are we seeing so many more leash reactive cases, and how our expectations of dogs have changed over time? You can tell Jessica loves her work as a dog trainer, and it was my pleasure to welcome her on The Deal with Animals. Thank you for joining me today. I'm so glad to have you on. Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
Sure. My name is Jessica Wheatcraft, and my pronouns are she, her.
Thank you so much. Now, why don't you tell us a little bit, in your words, about what you do and why?
So I am primarily a pet dog trainer. I've been a professional dog trainer for 15 years, and I primarily do this because I love dogs. I love the science behind training and behavior. And I also love people. And I love being that kind of liaison between helping the two of them have better communication and therefore better relationships and therefore better lives together.
It's interesting because you do meet a lot of dog people who say, well, I'm not really interested in people, but I have to learn to work with them. So it's nice. It's refreshing to hear someone who actually enjoys that part.
Yes, I do. I wanted to be a therapist, actually. That was when I was in high school. I really was drawn to psychology. And then when I was in college, I was trying to do as many psychology type classes as possible. But then when it came to really committing to that degree, I started to have some doubts, mainly because of what would the day-to-day job be like in that profession. And I felt there was a lot of it being indoors, maybe in an office, or if you're going to go on the research side, maybe you're still indoors and maybe in a laboratory or whatever you might be doing. And none of that appealed to me, actually. And so it was actually right around that same time that dog training fell into my lap. So I switched gears completely unexpectedly.
You can do indoors or outdoors therapy with dog training.
Exactly.
It is a lot of therapy, isn't it? And people tell you that it's not about, you know, that thing everybody says, it's not about training the dogs. It's about training the humans. And you're like, yeah, but it's more than that. It really is therapy to some extent. Like, I feel like maybe dog trainers do need to have some sort of minor in therapy work with humans. It would certainly be helpful, wouldn't it?
I would agree. Yes, we had there was a couple of conversations with some colleagues at the conference where we were saying how, yeah, we feel often like either a social worker or a therapist at times because of the level of emotions that are involved with this profession and how complicated things can get, specifically when a dog is displaying behavior issues in the home because it's so disruptive to their daily lives. And also because everybody in the household doesn't always agree on how to address that. And so you are navigating many pieces of that puzzle, and it is so much more than just working with the dog.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's so true. And when you have dogs fighting or there's an aggression issue in the house, people say that like the most stressful thing in your life is, you know, an moving, I think, and or a change of jobs or a death in the family. But honestly, having a dog who's aggressing, I think, has probably been one of the most stressful things in my life that has ever happened. It is just, it puts such a strain on every relationship in the house. Even relationships that you would consider good relationships, you know, are going to be strained by it. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun. And it can go on for a long time, too. It's not like there's a quick fix for this.
Yes. Yeah. It's very emotionally taxing.
So you mentioned the conference. You were speaker at the Aggression in Dogs Conference 2022 just this last weekend. And your talk was primarily about leash reactivity and, or that's your specialization. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that and the parts of that, that you really wanted to highlight for the listeners?
Sure. So I work a lot with leash reactivity cases. It's something that I started focusing on more about 10 years ago, partly out of necessity that there was just so many clients that were coming to me with that issue. It was something that was hard to escape. And what I really enjoyed about those cases is there are so many complexities and layers to it. And I started to notice that using the same approach or even a couple of approaches with any one dog didn't always work, but I started noticing that there was so much more that went into the cases. And I really wanted to dive into how could I best serve this individual dog and this individual owner? And how could I have this work for both of them? What's practical? What is still in the realm of positive reinforcement-based training approaches? And of course, meeting that individual dog's needs. And I think some of the pieces of taking reactivity cases is the element of the dog's sociability towards other dogs is, in my experience, a fairly large factor to it, in the sense that the how the dog feels about other dogs is in my opinion, a very driving force behind why the dog is reacting to begin with. And so diving into that dog, how do they feel about other dogs? What kind of experiences in life have they had with other dogs? Of course, that also translates to on leash and so forth. And so it was more about just teaching an incompatible behavior to me. It was more about, let me understand this dog and where he might be coming from. And then design the training program to best fit that particular dog. So I'd say that's a large area where I like to focus on. And I just also have a fascination with dog-to-dog sociability. It's been something that's a topic that has been hugely fascinating in my personal life with my personal dogs and so much because it's so complex and dogs are such individuals about what they like and what they don't like and why and what they'll tolerate and what they won't tolerate. And I find it so interesting. It is so much more complex than is your dog good with other dogs? That is not even the tip of the iceberg. So I really enjoy that, like that overall topic. And then I feel like that ties into a lot of these leash reactivity cases as well.
What is causing this? I mean, I know there's a lot of theories out there as to why it seems like there's so many more reactive dogs out there than there used to be, say, when I was a kid and we did let our dogs just kind of run free in the neighborhood, barely took the dog on leash walks ever. And I think a lot of people grew up in that sort of way. So again, what is your idea behind why this is happening so much?
Like all things, it's a combination of many factors. I grew up similar in the sense that my dogs, they didn't live in the house. They slept in the garage and then they had free run of our backyard and we maybe took them out once a week, if that. So the degree of exposure that they had to unknown dogs, which was much less than your average dog now. So some of it, I think, is a cultural shift that we have had with pet dogs, and the sense that everybody has an expectation of their dog as being their constant companion that they want to take everywhere. And that level of exposure is so much different than the level of exposure from dogs, you know, 30 years ago. When I think of me growing up in the 80s and 90s with our dogs, we didn't really take them out as frequently. And so some of it, I think, is this level of exposure. I think owning dogs in more urban environments has become more normalized. I don't know of any data on that, but I feel like just from my own anecdotal experiences is that when I was growing up, if you lived in an apartment, you just didn't own a dog. And that was just across the board, at least in my city, you know, like, oh, well, we don't have a yard. So that's why we can't have a dog. And now we have a lot of dogs that live in apartments. So they're in much smaller spaces where they then need to be taken out to get their needs met. So put on leash and taken out. So kind of, again, going back to that level of exposure, but also a lack of freedom, I would say. You know, they don't have the freedom to take care of their own needs by going out the back door and going to the bathroom when they need that. So they're kind of at our mercy to provide that for them. So I feel like some of it is, yeah, this cultural change with dogs, with the expectations that we have of them. Some of this is also likely some genetic influences. That is not my area of expertise, but I do know that a lot of the dogs that we are producing nowadays, I would say like the average, you know, dog that a client might get, isn't always suitable for a pet dog home. So I think some of this is going back to some genetics in terms of what are we breeding for? Are we really breeding for dogs that can handle city life or your average urban or suburban neighborhood? Or are we focusing on those traits? I don't think we are. And so I think that some of it is also coming down to genetics and certain temperaments and things that we are choosing over others, and not necessarily preparing dogs for the lives that they live. So I think that's part of it. But I also feel that there's a huge lag in education of how to meet your dog's needs. I would say that's probably the third element. We've got culture, we've got genetics and having dogs that aren't fit for it. And then we've got a lag in education in the sense that because this has changed so quickly for our pet dogs, everybody is still stuck way back when in terms of their understanding of dogs, what can we do to meet their needs. And I think when we combine all of those things, I'm not surprised that we're having problems. That I don't know how you could expect any animal to have all those factors with them and somehow be able to cope in this life.
Yeah. There's just so many things that go into it, aren't there? It's never just one answer. This idea, again, that my dogs were just sort of, they just ran through the neighborhood and they met dogs and then they came home and were covered in mud. And you're like, oh, okay. So now everybody needs a bath. And, you know, this idea that they are always in our house or they're always under our control. And yet these days they kind of have to be, don't they? Because they haven't had that exposure, maybe, of that more of a free living lifestyle. That now when they do get out, you say that other sort of exposure where they're now on leash and they can't just kind of go and do what they want. They're starting to be a lot more reactive, and social issues, genetic issues, all of those things are definitely part of that recipe, yeah. I guess. Bad yes. recipe.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like where people want to take their dogs has changed, and that's also part of it. And that has actually changed since I started my training career. So 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, there was a lot less dog daycares. That really exploded, especially in the San Diego area over the past decade. We when people would call us in for training, it was more, I just want to be able to take my dog for a walk around the neighborhood and some different things. And now it's, well, I want to be able to bring my dog to a brewery and they're, you know, barking or growling at people or dogs that walk past the table. Or I really want to be able to bring my dog to the farmer's market or a really, really busy environment that's not really suited for most dogs. I don't know a lot of dogs that love going to a brewery. Most of the times when I see the dogs there, I can't help it. I'm always looking at the dogs and I'm always looking at their body language. And I would say a large amount of them, I'm not going to say all dogs, I'm going to say a lot of them that I'm seeing are owners that are not paying any attention to their dog and how they're navigating or moving through that environment. So they're almost left to fend for themselves, except they're typically on leashes. Sometimes they're tethered and they're just supposed to just stay put as tons of strange people walk by and maybe want to reach out and pet them, and strange dogs are going by and the owner's not paying any attention to them or helping or supporting them through that. And no wonder why. I mean, I don't know anybody who would enjoy that experience. So some of it is also just the, that is probably more recent, just in my experience, last decade, is where people want to take their dogs is different. That expectation of constant companion and bring them everywhere with me because they're really supposed to enjoy this because I enjoy this is a really common request.
Yeah, because as much as dogs like people, they don't necessarily want to be around dozens of people they don't know under their feet and potentially getting stepped on or touched by people they don't know, right? That doesn't sound like anybody's fun time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I know when I was taking clients way back in the day, I was not comfortable teaching leash skills initially. Like I just didn't, I hadn't read anything in any of the dog training books that I had read or any of the courses I had taken that taught leash skills other than really basic stuff. So when it came to reactivity, I was not looking forward to the first client who asked me about that, but I knew it was coming. So I started looking and trying to find information and books on the subject. And there was very little out there, but it was really hard to try to find anything. I ended up having to sort of come up with my own techniques based on, you know, a couple of sort of ideas from a couple of books that I'd read rather than books about how to work with leash reactivity. So how did you come up with your techniques and what did you kind of focus on when you started taking these clients?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate that when I first got into training, I had a mentor. So the trainer that I hired to help me with my dog was Nan Arthur, and she asked me if I would work with her, and I worked with her for 7 years. So I'm probably one of the few who had that experience. And I followed Nan around, especially the first 2 or 3 years in all of my spare time. I would follow her to all of her lessons and I just shadowed her and I tried to absorb as much as I could. And I essentially had her at my disposal for any questions. And when I was working with clients, I could ask her for feedback. And then if I was in over my head, she would come to the client with me to support me and see what could we do to switch gears here with this program. So I was very, very fortunate that I had that in-person help right at my fingertips. I know that a lot of people don't have that. I was also working for her and her company. So it wasn't, so it was mutually beneficial. And so with that, I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from my work with shelter and rescue dogs. I would say that was one of the areas where I was able to get my hands on a variety of dogs without necessarily the pressure of an owner there or an expectation of having to deliver something. And so I was the training director of Pitbull Rescue San Diego, which is a rescue group that isn't in existence anymore, but was quite large at the time in like the early 2000s. And so by fostering dogs, by supporting other foster parents, teaching some classes, got my hands on a lot of different dogs that way as well. That was very valuable, in addition to evaluating dogs that we might pull from the shelter. So I did a lot of evaluations of pit bulls at our local shelters. So those two things were huge. And then some of it was me just going, and I attended a lot of conferences. That was the other thing. I was very familiar with Grisha Stewart's work from the very beginning when she first came out with Bat. I also was involved with Cat, the very, very first version that just had just come out. A group of trainers and I in San Diego actually set up a Cat session in terms of could we execute this and follow this plan and see what would happen. So I had a lot of opportunities to like practice some of these things in person. And then some of it was a little bit of, I would just say, was learning on the fly. I can still remember that early in my career when I was first taking some leash activity cases on my own, I still remember this one case where we were working on offered eye contact back in the day that used to be my default of, okay, this is how I'm going to approach these cases is I'm going to reinforce offered eye contact a lot. I'm going to start building that around distractions. And then I'm going to add in the distraction of another dog. And that's going to be the environmental cue for the eye contact. And I thought this is a great recipe and this will fix everything. And I still remember this dog that we tried to do that with, but he couldn't take his eyes off of the other dog. And I wouldn't really necessarily describe him as being over threshold, but it was at that point that I thought, okay, I need to reinforce something else here. Like this dog can't do this in this moment. And so I thought, well, what if I just reinforce him for just looking at the dog first? And so I just thought maybe I'll just lower my criteria here, even though I'd never even heard about doing that. So I changed my approach with that dog and it worked. And then later, wasn't that long later, I learned that Alice Tong had the engage, disengage. And I saw this whole article about it. I thought, oh my gosh, this is so cool. She actually has it written out. And that was exactly what I was doing. And I saw that she had actually written a whole protocol about it. So so some of it just kind of led me down that road. But I would say that I always stayed very open to learning from others. And I actually spent quite a bit of time shadowing as many trainers as I could, even as I was way, I actually still do that whenever I can. Can I learn something from another trainer? Can you teach me this? So I always try to open myself as much as I could from learning from other trainers. So I would say that's a kind of how I learned my current skill set.
So why did you start going for reactivity then? Was it just circumstantial? You just started taking a lot of cases or was there a deliberate focus on working with aggression and reactive dogs?
Yeah, I always loved the puzzle of behavior modification. So I loved, okay, what do I need to know? What piece is relevant here? So I always loved that. So I always had a love for behavior cases in general. And I know that a lot of the work that I'm putting out more recently is on leash reactivity, but I have done a lot of work with dog-to-dog aggression, dog-to-human aggression, resource guarding. I've done numerous cases of those things as well. So, but with leash reactivity, some of it started coming out in that, well, I would say two things. So one, I just started taking a lot of the cases. So a lot of people just started referring to me. So it was just, oh, you have a reactive dog, just call Jessica. So some of it was just, these were just the referrals I was getting. And so all of a sudden it seemed like all of my clients had the same problem. But then when you just do the same thing every day, you start to get good at it and you start to find lots of different ways that you can help those dogs. And then I actually started designing special services for reactive dogs. I started designing special group classes for reactive dogs that I taught. So I had a whole program with my last business, Synergy Dog Training, where clients might start privately with their reactive dog and then move into maybe semi-privates with just one other dog or a very small group class with only three dogs in it and continue to build your skill set. And so I also gave my clients more opportunities to practice with their reactive dog because they needed it. They needed to still have those controlled environments to practice in until they got more of their confidence. And it also really helped their dogs to expand their skill set into other environments. And essentially, if you think about it, it's just expanding their world instead of having to stay, you know, super close to home or being only in environments that are really quiet. They built their skill set, which then allowed them more opportunities to spend more time and do different stuff with their humans.
That's great. So, you know, it's an issue that's affecting so many people right now. You know, if you talk to anybody, if they had one thing that they would want to change about their dog's behavior, it's almost always their leash skills. It's a big problem. So I think that anybody who has been able to focus on that is going to get a lot of clients, frankly, because, you know, there's just, that's kind of the thing that everybody needs the most, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That's great. So we need more of you around. We need a Jessica for every city. That's what we need.
Yes. Yes. Part of my more recent work has been coaching other trainers. And so that I felt was, could be my next, you know, contribution to this world. And it's, you know what, I really just want to help other trainers be able to have more skills so that they can feel more confident and more empowered by taking these same types of clients as well. So that's it.
Well, good. Then we will have a Jessica in every city. That's excellent. Good news. So what's, let you do my work for me. What's the best question anyone has ever asked you?
Ooh, the best question that someone has ever asked.
If somebody was going to come to you and just be like, you know, they just ask you the question that really gets to the heart of it, what would be that question? What would you want someone to ask you?
What's the right dog for me? I think that's a huge one. And that also goes into kind of the thing where we said, what is the, why are we in this position? Why are there so many reactive dogs? Because part of it is, well, where are these people getting their dogs? And what kind of knowledge are they going into, or what kind of knowledge do they have going into that situation to determine if the dog that they're wanting to bring into their home is actually a good fit for their lifestyle? Because they're often driven by everything except common sense. They're driven by their emotions. If they see a really cute puppy or, oh my goodness, I have in San Diego, there's a really whole black market, so to speak, of people that breed dogs across the border, bring them up on the other side and meet clients in a parking lot and tell them, oh, this is an 8-week-old golden retriever. And it's really like a 4-week-old, little poodle mix or something like that. And it's terrible. And so, but then the client feels, it felt wrong, but I couldn't leave the dog there. Then they take the dog anyways. And it turns into, then that grows up to be something that was not the best fit. Or if in terms of getting access to a quality breeder, that's something that I think is still very difficult for a lot of people to do. And I think that some of the other emotional aspect is that they want a dog soon. Well, my dog just passed away and I need another dog right now. And a lot of people don't understand that a lot of the best breeders out there have waiting lists, and you might be waiting for a couple of years to get that dog. And that's not always something that somebody's wanting to do. And so that's so if someone was going to ask me, yes, what's the best dog for me? I feel like that would be a huge preventative measure to set that person up for a greater chance of a lifetime of a really fulfilling and healthy relationship with their dog.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, it was always nice when somebody comes to you with a puppy, isn't it? Because you're like, yes, they're getting a jump on things. They're not going to, even with the best genetics, you can create a reactive behavior in any dog. So, you know, it's so nice when people get a good head start, but wouldn't it be great if they came to you even before they had the puppy, you know, like, hey, I'm going to get a puppy. What should I get? Or I'm going to get a dog. You know, what should I be looking for? I've got these skills and this is my lifestyle, and mm-hmm. really be able to get an animal that's going to fit happily into your home.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That is huge.
That's a really good question. That's a good question. People should think about that one.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if there was a book you could gift to all of the listeners, what would that be?
So I thought about this. So there's so many fantastic books out there on dogs and training and behavior and even just animals and training. And I'm like, oh, there's no way I could pick just one. So I think that one of the best books that somebody could get, specifically if they're in this industry, or even just the average person. So one of my favorite books is Atomic Habits by James Clear. And I say that as being my recommended book, because when I think about perhaps people in my industry who have all of this knowledge, and I think the question is, well, what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do with that knowledge? What are you going to, is it going to be that you're going to start that blog, or you're going to start that podcast, or are you going to start your own business, or are you going to expand your business? And how are you going to do that? And a lot of that comes down to our daily habits, the type of discipline that we have on a daily basis. And so that book was really pivotal for me in terms of understanding my daily habits. How can I make sure I'm spending more time doing the things that are productive? I want to be careful with my words there, because our value is not just based on how productive we are, but if you have a goal and you want to accomplish something, there is always going to be a degree of discipline that's involved. And that discipline also comes down to your habits. And so I love that book. It is very easy to read, very user-friendly. It's fantastic.
That's great. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting one. And you're right. Productivity is important. I have to say this to myself all the time. Like, I can't sit down. You know, you want to like get stuff done all the time. And if you're not getting stuff done, then what are you doing? Right? What is even the point? This is what leads to depression in early parenthood, as well as pregnancy, by the way, speaking from experience. Like, if you can't get anything done, it's because your body's already working really hard.
Yes. Yes, 100%, 100%. Yes, it could be a tricky line when we use the word productivity. But I still feel like there's so many of us though who, gosh, I wish I could start this, or it means so much to me, and I can't do it, or I've never done it. And so yeah. I think when I think of that, I think to well, what are the things that might be helpful in terms of some tools there. And so
that's great. Fun. Yeah. A book like that's such a good starting off point for trying to get something new going. Mm-hmm. So would you share a pivotal moment in your early career, maybe that put you on the path to what you're doing now?
Yeah. So that would be the initial phone call that I had with Naomi Arthur when I contacted her about my dog. And I have kind of a crazy memory with certain things. I still remember sitting in my car having this phone conversation. I must have only been 20 years old. So it was a long time ago. And I remember prior to that, you know, I was searching for help with my dog. I had a pit bull that I adopted at the time that had some behavior issues. She was reactive on leash. She was also, I wouldn't call her dog aggressive by any means, but she certainly had just had certain things she wouldn't tolerate. And she didn't hesitate to tell other dogs that she didn't tolerate certain things. And I didn't know what to do with that. And so when I had gone to other trainers, and their approach, it didn't really make sense to me. I remember I even had gone to a shot collar trainer. And I remember I knew enough about behavior at that point that I knew that I could understand a bit more about reinforcement and punishment. And when I asked them, hey, so when are you actually using the collar? Because they were doing a demonstration of my dog sitting. You know, she knew sit, but they wanted to do a demo. And I said, so when are you actually using the collar? And they just kind of like smirked at me and didn't answer my question. And I thought, well, that's weird. It didn't sit right with me. That was back in the day. I didn't know a difference between training. I just thought you just find a trainer, you just go to them. This is what you do. So it wasn't until I had that phone call with Nan, and she spent probably at least 30 minutes on the phone with me. And she was asking me all these questions about my dog's history and her medical history and all sorts of things. And I thought, oh, wow, there's actually so much more that goes into this than I had even thought. And that was the very beginning of my story of where I then hired her to come in. And when I learned about clicker training, and of course, you know, that falls under, you know, positive reinforcement based training and slicing behavior down and reinforcing it, I think I thought that whole time up to my whole life, I thought I was really communicating with dogs and really was bonding with them. And I, after that, and after working with Nan, it completely shifted my perception in the sense that I started to view my training as communication, and that communication is almost being an art form, in that it was such a give and take, and it was such a looking at my dog and adjusting based on her response. It would change my response, and there was such a depth to it that I didn't even know existed in dogs. And I had at that point had thought, oh, I have so much experience with my dogs. I've been around them my whole life, you know, all that stuff. It was a whole nother world that opened up to me. And that was so special to me. And that's what I try to give to my clients.
Nice. I love too, that you worked with animals that were coming from the shelter as well so much, because gosh, you can learn so much from them. Like all of the books do not prepare you for, you know, applying that theory and having the dog go, nah, that's not going to work for me. This recipe is not my recipe. And then having to actually look at the dog and ask them, okay, well, what is your recipe? What is going to work for you? And yeah, you can learn a lot from the shelter dogs. And, you know, those are the dogs that need it the most too often, because they've been, you know, a lot of worse experiences, even just, you know, losing a family than other dogs would have had, even if there's never abuse or anything like that, you know, in their background. Just losing your family is pretty traumatic. So
yes,
that's great.
Absolutely.
Oh, what do you think is the deal with animals?
I think the deal with animals, and I'm going to just stick to dogs, since that's the animal we're talking about in this podcast. I think that we are experiencing a clash of so many of the things that we had talked about at the beginning of this podcast, of that cultural shift of our expectations of dogs have since changed. And while I think that culturally, some of the areas that have changed for good is that positive reinforcement based training has become much more mainstream than it was in the past. So I would say that's one aspect of the cultural shift with dogs that I am quite happy about and feel like most people nowadays know about it. But we're still dealing with so much of this sudden shift in our lifestyle with dogs. And I feel like that's coming to a head. And it's coming to a head in the sense that we're seeing so many more serious behavior problems right now. And we're seeing that because of all of the spay and neuter, which drastically reduced our shelter pet population, then also drastically reduced opportunities for behaviorally sound dogs to reproduce. So now we have less behaviorally sound dogs.
Just as a quick aside here, the concept that Jessica is referring to is the idea that due to the mass spay and neuter of dogs in shelters and rescues to reduce populations and therefore euthanasia, but without regard to whether those dogs are behaviorally sound or not, means that while many dogs who definitely should not be reproducing in the gene pool based on their behavior and genetic traits are getting neutered, many dogs who are wonderful family companions, who would be dogs that we would want to introduce into the gene pool, are not getting a chance to pass on their traits. The idea is, this is leading to animals that are not only being bred for physical traits by breeders, looking for a profit rather than the overall good of the canine species. These breeders want to breed dogs for cuteness rather than emotional and behavioral stability. They're leaning in to try to provide specific breed qualities like less shedding coat or smooshed faces. While I have yet to see any documented research on the subject, it is an idea that has been circulating in the animal welfare community for some years now.
And at this point, I feel like the deal with animals is that it's getting to an unfortunate place. I think that some of the things that we have learned a lot from Kim Brophy and a lot of her work in the recent years is really opening up more eyes to what pet dogs actually are. And even though I think that we're not at the best place, I think the deal with dogs right now is not good. But I will say that even though it's not very good and things are not going to change in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years, there is a lot of stuff that's going on and behind the scenes that I think a lot of pet owners don't even know about. And a lot of that was really illustrated with some of the concepts and ideas and stuff that were talked about at the Aggression in Dogs conference. There's a significant amount of people that are out there that are trying to address all of these different issues. And so I am very hopeful for the future. I think that we are going to start shifting more towards how can we meet our dogs' needs and how can we see them for who they are, and more of that and less of I need my dog to come to the brewery with me because it makes me feel better about it. I think we're eventually going to get there. We're just in a bit of a limbo at the moment.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
That was Jessica Wheatcraft, and you can find out more about Jessica at instinctdogtraining.com. Now, there's one more episode in the Aggression in Dogs Conference miniseries that will go out on Monday. Then we'll be back to a regular schedule of posting every Monday. Join me again in the next episode to talk with Marco Atta, as we're going to discuss the overall themes for the conference and what those topics might mean for our relationships with dogs in the future. If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com. Leave me a message. I will always read them. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. The Deal with Animals was produced by me, your host, Marika S. Bell, and theme music was composed by Kai Stranskoff. Until next time, what do you think is the deal with animals? The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network. What do you think is the deal with animals?